once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and Jake McClure on this Saturday, January 30th, 2016, the last Personal Wealth Coach presentation of January 2016.
This is a historic moment because it is also the last time we've had a program since last Saturday.
Right. And the last time until next Saturday. And I will say this will be the worst program we have presented since last week.
Right. It will be not only that, this is also momentous in that it is the only program that we will do all day.
Yes.
This is That's true. Write headlines for the market.
Yeah,
this is the last time the market has been at this point since yesterday.
This is the furthest the market has fallen since September.
3 months ago, we had is the last time we can see anything like this happening.
Well, they don't say it that way. This is the worst that has happened since 3 months ago. They don't say 3 months ago. They say since last September.
No, there's even something more momentous that goes beyond even us.
What?
Next week, February starts, and this is the first time that we've had a February.
In 2016. Right. And this is the first 2016 February in history.
Right. Not only that, it's the first time we've had a February with 29 days in it for like 4 years.
Yes. This is the first. Oh, boy, on the 29th of February. See, this is the longest February in 4 years. What does that mean to the economy and the markets?
Global warming.
Oh. Yes. When February is 1 day longer than it was the previous 3 years.
Mm.
Northern hemisphere warming is not too far behind.
Right. What we will be able to find is that we will have more temperature readings this year than we did last year.
Right.
By 24 hours.
You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and we need to disclose that we are also Jake, and this is Jeff over here talking. You can tell because we're both wearing plaid today.
Well, you're not really wearing plaid. You're wearing check.
Looks plaidish to me. At any rate, that we are also the principals of an investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, called the Personal Wealth Coach. We need to tell you that.
Yes.
And
we lost our caller. Somebody was calling in to tell us.
And there's a regulatory agency that supervises us, so if you think we're violating the rules, you're certainly welcome to give them a call. And it's called the United States Securities and Exchange Commission.
Otherwise known as the SEC, but not the college football group.
With which we are registered.
Right.
Yes, so we're registered. So we're registered investment advisor as opposed to the nasty unregistered version, which by definition would be illegal.
Yes.
Anyway. So we're here. You're there. Telephone numbers in here are 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And did anything happen this week?
Having just talked about the recent records approaching and happening, this is the first 30th day of January in the entire existence of the universe that has happened in 2016. So what else has happened this week? Yes, we had market movements.
Yes, we had actually an amazing event happen this week that hasn't happened. I don't think it's happened all year. Maybe we had one, I don't know. But since the entire year so far, we have not had a week. The market, the major indexes in the market were up this week.
So it's the first time this year, which has had, 4 weeks in it so far.
Right.
For it a little bit of. There's some change. So notice how nobody ever breaks a week for you. You can break a 20.
You can break a week.
I'd like a little bit of extra
you get the
time
days.
Given back,
right.
Please. I mean, I'm
so,
just want to use 1 day this week. That's all.
Yeah, and so we actually had the various, and I'm looking here somewhere, I've got the Glimmer of Hope, Weak American Gazes.
S&P 500 closed at 1,940.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it did that. It's up, 1.4%, as I recall?
For the week. For the day, it was up 2.48.
But it was only up 1.4 for the week. So.
Right.
So that could mean something. What it really boils down to.
Gross. Who wants to boil the market?
is the market has risen about 4.4% since the middle of last week. Now, is that a horrific, wonderful, amazing, or shocking thing? It all depends on how you read the numbers.
Or the headlines. And what Chicken Little person is talking versus optimist. Yes.
So the point is that we've now had a week and a half of rising market, which, let me tell you, in this particular downturn is the longest run upward so far this year. And I think it's significant. And the reason I think it could be, and it certainly there's certainly a lot of pundits, I would even go so far as to say the majority of them, who are saying this is what's called a dead cat bounce, which is not a very nice thing to talk about. But that's what they call it on Wall Street, which is basically to say that, no, this is not an indication that the worst is over and the best is yet to come. It is simply an indication that the market is going to fall further.
That's what one very large group of people is saying.
Well, that's the fact that that group of people is that much overweight. Yeah. I don't think should lend anything to it. We have a caller on 773-1400, and well, if I can get the right buttons pushed here, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was reading the Barron's Roundtable articles, part one and part two, and with very few exceptions, they all were talking about the global challenges from a financial and investment standpoint. I was wondering if you could comment on that and kind of put it all in perspective. I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
Boy.
Oh, boy.
Certainly.
Could you talk about the problems of the world?
That's
but
it.
Just in general, you know, just in general. Yes, we can. And I actually am pretty prepared to talk about one area of that is in a lot of people's minds. There's a economist named Michael Pettis, who specializes in China and has spoken in China quite a lot. I was watching China, and he wrote a blog this week. I realized that makes him almost sound like he's a blogger, but when an economist writes a blog, it's not the same kind of blog as what you ate at Starbucks or whatever. He really did an amazing job of talking point by point about the strengths and weaknesses of the Chinese economy. And I was very impressed. This is the best summation, and the summation was only about 3,000 words long. So it was the summation needs a summation.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, China instigated the downturn in our markets both back in August of last year and the more recent downturn that we've had at the beginning of this year. China's markets going into free fall, and by free fall I don't mean our flirting with bear market area. I mean they drop 60% and then rise 50% and then drop 60%. Their free fall is a lot different than ours. And he goes into a lot of detail talking about, first, the Chinese economy is not collapsing. We've talked about that on the air quite a bit, that it's that the growth is slowing down. However, in the future, be prepared for increasing bumpiness. The way the Chinese are funding their expansion, even the expansion that they're having now, which is slower, is through credit. And so by credit, right? When a company needs capital to grow or to start, this is a common question. Where does that capital come from? Do you save it yourself? And Austin is kind of famous right now because it's the center of startups in the United States, and there's a lot of venture capital that comes in, people that are willing to risk their own money to dump it into new startups. In China, you don't have venture capitalists except from overseas. Except for a very small amount of the funding internally. Most of it comes from credit. And during the Great Recession, the Chinese government was really good at controlling where that credit was coming from. Because they got so good at controlling where that credit was coming from, they spawned a sort of a black market for loans, where lots of people are loaning money to lots of other people, and there are kind of conglomerations of loan people happening. And What it means is that we don't know how much debt is held in China. The head of their central bank has come out and said that they need at least $3 trillion in overseas reserves in order to maintain the reserve requirement to bail out enough of the debt that's out there. And I know this is getting really dry. So this is one of the reasons why when people say, what if they sell all of their U.S. treasuries? They can't. It would put their economy in free fall. Unless they can deleverage, unless they can take the growth and make it off of profit instead of off of loans, then they're in for a really tough time in about 5 years, maybe before, maybe later. But I am in complete agreement with this particular analysis. The demographics don't look good starting then, and the debt level is just getting tremendous.
Well, you say that China instigated this. I don't know. This is one of the things that's kind of interesting. This rally that we've seen in the last week and a half has been in spite of the fact that the markets have continued to fall in China.
I agree.
Markets in China are not reflective of what's going on in China.
Correct.
The fact that China is growing at 6-point-something percent as opposed to 7-point-something percent or 10% or 12%, which it was at one point, really shouldn't come as a really big surprise.
It's pretty normal.
The point that Jake was making about China is that the Chinese, and we've been saying this for a lot of years, the Chinese economy is unsustainable. Now, let me put that in perspective. There have been a lot of people, and this is particularly as we come up on an election, I think it's a good idea to step back and think about who said, and what their philosophy was, who said the Chinese are going to take over? Who said the Japanese are going to take over? Who said you should go out and buy gold, which is, by the way, down about 50% from where it was? Who told you to do these things, and what was their rationale? Because this is the test of whether a political economic, and I say political economic because it's one thing when people talk about politics and another thing when they throw economics in.
Yeah. Political economists are not real economists. When you get with a group of economists, they look around and they look at the people that are speaking politically and they kind of laugh because it's not motivated by study.
We live in a socio-political economy. You can't separate those three things. So if you back up, you probably can remember that there is a philosophy that says we should be having runaway inflation right now. Now, it's hard to remember that there was a side of the political spectrum and a group of people who were claiming we were going to have runaway inflation, you should buy gold. We are having runaway deflation.
I wouldn't call it runaway, but we're definitely having deflation.
If we have something runaway, the reason I say that, it's not runaway yet. But the central banks in 23% of the world economy right now, 23 to 25%, depending on how you measure it, are charging negative interest rates.
Japan just this week announced that.
And that's by the way, the market turnaround was largely because Japan announced negative interest rates. The price of oil also went up. Now, price of oil is what's driving the markets more than anything else, and it's a bad signal. It's a signal that I want to get into, that why the price of oil is a very poor signal for markets to follow. Here's the key. When you talk about world economic weakness, the United States is the strongest growth center by a huge margin on the planet. Fortunately, we happen to have the largest economy in the world, so we're basically holding the world out of recession. And when you talk about when the economists are talking about the United States is working against a headwind, actually it's more like a drag. It's hard. It's good to remember that unemployment in Spain is still around 10%. The total growth in the Eurozone for the fourth quarter was 0.4%, and they measure it slightly differently than we do. But ours was 0.7. Big deal. But in the Eurozone, they officially have for large deposits a negative interest rate at this point. We're moved up to a quarter. And the issue is, yes, there is a huge drag going on out there in the world economy, and it is one that is going to be hard for us to surmount, but it won't necessarily drag us into some kind of recession.
Here are some things that could. And I'm saying that could because these are political motivated items that could drag recession across the world. If we start closing borders to trade, if we start increasing tariffs, if we start attacking each other over trade, we're going to see some really, really bad situations going forward.
We could pass Smoot-Hawley. And very frankly, there's two presidential candidates at least, one on the left, one on the right.
Right. Extreme left, extreme right, both saying...
Right. And there's tariffs.
Even
Senator Cruz has talked about throwing up barriers. That is what turned the financial crisis of 1929 into the Great Depression of the 1930s I'm not trying to say that they have the corner on this, but it was conservative Republicans in the Congress who passed Smoot-Hawley.
Yeah.
And a conservative Republican president.
But you have to realize that at that point, the Republicans were, while conservative, it was a different type of conservatism because...
They're greatly different from the conservatives of today.
The issues, the platform was different.
Well,
they were conservative on different issues. Fiscally, they were pretty much the same.
They wanted to cut spending and close the borders and save jobs in the United States and cut us off from the rest of the world. And
pretty much
what Bernie Sanders is saying, very much what Donald Trump is saying, to a lesser extent what Ted Cruz is saying. He's talked about tariffs too. And the issue is if we started a tariff war, we would reenact the errors that there's an absolute consensus on that caused A, the Great Depression, and B, World War II.
Right. We were attacked by Japan because they felt like we were at war over trade. Mm-hmm. It was completely unforgivable because the world doesn't look at trade as being war.
They did. The Chinese do too, by the way.
We would not be starting the war, and that's the dangerous part. The skirmishes already exist out there. Lots of countries are throwing up trade barriers. Lots of them. And it tends to happen when countries are having difficulty financially. They think it's a good idea to look inward and continue to support somehow a weakened economy. And this is something that most conservatives will understand and agree with because it's the same rationale that, I'll tell you what I'm talking about. Republicans should understand this in that if you have a company out there that has overextended and it's weakened itself and it's not competitive anymore, you have a couple of choices that you could do. One, you can let it try to fix itself. Or two, you can have the government step in and fix it for it and somehow prop it up with government funding by allowing them to raise prices without competition and so on. And most Republicans look at that concept and go, that is insane. The government should not be getting involved in the free market. And yet when it comes to inter-country trade, when we're trading with the rest of the world, the same people that say that that's insane say, put those tariffs on because the labor in Malaysia is cheaper than the labor in the United States. The reality is that if we don't get competitive and stay competitive, then we will have a weak economy no matter what the government does. And if the government keeps propping up a weak economy, it just gets weaker. We're strengthening the weaknesses. So when tariffs are thrown up, when countries say, I'm going to charge you to import a car, or I'm going to charge you to import a banana, it's putting an artificial prop on their own industry, which is not able to compete. What's going on in Europe right now over taxes is what I'm talking about, tariffs. there is a real problem with the tax rates in these big corporations that are in Europe or elsewhere, you know, Google, Amazon, lots of places, set up in Ireland. Ireland says we have a very low corporate tax rate. So all this cash is building up overseas in American companies. The European Union is pushing to sue those companies so that they can get taxes from American companies in France and in Germany and in Italy at a higher rate than it's being charged in Ireland. The U.S. Treasury Department is coming out and saying, whoa, whoa, you guys don't have priority here. You guys don't, these are not Italian companies or German companies. They may do business there, but old school, we get taxes first, then you do. And the Treasury Department is saying they're following the law as it stands. You can't sue them to get more. You're creating extra jurisdiction tax zones that don't exist. So free trade is more than a concept. If I'm trying to sell a widget, whatever the widget is, to someone in Oklahoma, yes, Oklahoma has a different set of taxes than Texas does. It has different taxes than what happened in Manhattan or New York. However, if someone's selling something in Illinois from Manhattan, Manhattan doesn't charge the sales tax for Manhattan on it. They let Illinois do it. That works very well in a free trade zone. Outside of a free trade zone, if both Manhattan and Illinois tax it, then the company's going to just stop selling things in Illinois. That's not good.
The backside of that is if I buy something from an online seller in California where they have a sales tax,
mm-hmm.
and I buy it in Texas where we have a sales tax, right. and they don't have a business location in Texas, I don't pay sales tax in either place.
Correct.
But the company on
and that's
its
really
profits,
what this is about.
The company on its profits pays the taxes in California.
Right. In California, if they're based in California. In the United States, if they're based in the United States. So yeah. there's a base tax.
Well, if they have a subsidiary in Ireland, it's the subsidiary in Ireland that pays that. Of course, the
right.
issue is simply if the and this is the point. If the European Union really wants to do something about this, they say to Ireland, raise your corporate tax rates to the same levels everybody else has.
That's what they're working on right now. The European Union, the Spanish, the Italians, the Greeks, and the French are pushing really hard to get a universal tax so that places like Ireland can't give incentives to corporations to come and invest in their country. It is exactly the same kind of class system that I abhor elsewhere.
And so that's all not necessarily in direct response to the question we got. By the way, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and our telephone number is in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400. Let me wrap that up. There's just one or two more sentences. That's what I mean by the tariff war that could get started, because just like as Republicans are, well, I'm about to go into another paragraph here. Just like as Republicans are aware, the welfare system's really moved away from writing checks and into tax credits. The tax system, or whether how much and how little you tax someone, whether you give taxes back as a refund or don't charge them to begin with, is just as much a tariff as if you say you get charged for taking this item in and out of a country. And that's something that really needs to be scrutinized and looked at. If we don't, we could lead the whole economy of the world into some pretty big problems.
When we talk about what's going on in the markets versus what's going on in the economy, let me hit a couple of points here, and maybe we'll go into more detail later. Yeah, we just had a GDP report for the quarter that annualized indicates that in the fourth quarter, the GDP of the United States grew 0.7%, which sounds pretty darned anemic. However, I want to, and I mentioned this in the newsletter we published last night, it's important to recognize what's going on here. GDP is a measure in dollars. Now, that means that if the price of gasoline were to drop dramatically and people bought more gasoline, which, by the way, they did.
Yes.
their gasoline, their gasoline purchases were down, despite the fact they bought more gasoline. I mean, that's what the GDP is. The GDP shows dollars. The profit margin on gasoline has dropped because the price, there's a, in essence, a price war going on at the gas stations. And the oil companies have gasoline sitting in tanks that would cost them a lot more to produce than you're actually paying at the pump right now, which is hurting them more. I mean, the oil companies are hurting, and they're hurting very, very seriously. But that doesn't mean that the economy is slowing down. And this is the point I want to make. One of the big negatives that showed up in the fourth quarter GDP was energy spending. Well, that's not because we didn't use as much energy. Although there's some of that, because we, by the way, in the fourth quarter, we had the warmest, wettest fourth quarter since records have been kept. And as a result, a lot of heating, a lot of electricity, and a lot of heating oil was not used. And I know people say, oh, well, you're advocating for global warming. Yeah, I'm telling you. It was warmer in the fourth quarter than any three-month period, any of those 3 months since records have been kept in the United States across the country. As a result, we had a lowered expenditure on things that make places warm. Also,
coconut prices went down, as well as tomato prices, because it's warmer all over the place, and coconuts are having a bumper crop, so are tomatoes.
And a lot of retail numbers are down, not because people are not spending money. Mainly because they're not buying warm coats. They're not buying winter clothes because they're not cold. And when you get that type of anomaly that pops in during a quarter, it's really important to pay attention to it. There's a couple of other things. The dollar it's not at record highs, but it's getting pretty close, at least in recent history. And when the dollar gets really, really high, the first thing people tend to think about is, oh, my goodness gracious, our exports are going to be hurt. And they have been.
Our imports look great, though.
When we import things, though, when a company buys, let's say Dell buys components to put in its computers and it's buying them from somewhere in Asia, it's spending less money on those components. And that shows up as the GDP as a reduction in spending. So,
right.
So what we're saying is there's a lot of distortion in the GDP record. The key is if you take a look at what the gross domestic product of the United States did during the entire year, it grew at about 2.4 to 2.5%, depending on whose numbers we listen to right now, and those are going to change. Almost exactly the same thing it grew the year before. And since the average since 2009 has been 2.1% growth.
It's slightly higher than
slightly
it
higher.
Has
now,
been.
Okay, now everybody's saying, oh, we need to get back to 3% growth. Hang on. I know that when GDP is figured, inflation is taken out of it. But I also know that they don't take it all out. They can't. In this environment, across the globe, I mentioned earlier on that 23% of the global economy is in a negative interest rate environment. That is unique.
Yeah.
Even during the Great Depression, as far as I know, we never had negative interest rates.
I wouldn't call it unique. I would call it very, very early banking history.
Okay. I can't imagine banks paying people to borrow money from them.
No. And they're not paying people
to
borrow.
Well, they are in some places.
What I'm talking about here is the original banking model was you would put money in a bank to keep it safe.
Right.
And you would pay them to keep it safe. It
right.
was more of a vault type expense. You
right.
paid them to have it there, which is the negative interest rate on deposits. Japan is not not giving people money to make loans. Japan is just charging people to take deposits. And
well,
parts of Northern Europe are paying people to
yes.
give them loans.
And that's what I mean. When you have a real negative interest rate in the world, and believe it or not, here in the United States we do. I realize that it gets complicated trying to figure that out. But if you look at, for instance, the what treasury bonds, notes, not so much the bonds, but the notes and the bills are paying, you look at the fact that the majority of people who do that have to pay taxes on it, which reduces the yield.
Right.
And you look at the probable low but still existing inflation over the life expectancy of that particular security, you realize those people are receiving a negative interest rate. So when we're in a negative interest rate environment,
that just let's take it another.
A small gain is bigger than it seems like it
right.
is.
Let's go to another position, and this is one that a lot of people will get really quickly. Mortgage interest rates are around 3.5% to 4%.
Mm-hmm. Well, they just dropped a little bit.
Right. Yeah. They just dropped, so that's why they're 3.5%. So they were up at around 4%. Now they're down to between 4 and 3.5, depending on credit scores, depending on how much money you have to put down, the length of the loan, all that good stuff. Okay. Let's give a hypothetical. Say you have a loan for 4%. Say you get a better loan. You got a 3.5% loan. If you are in a tax bracket that is, say, 25%, then a quarter of that interest is not being paid because the taxes say, you know, it's being paid to the bank, but you're not having to pay it in taxes because you can, if you're at 25% interest on the taxes, a quarter of that 3.5 comes back to you in that you don't have to write it as taxes. So now you're talking about 1/4 dropping. We're now talking about right around the 2.25% range, mm-hmm. which is what inflation is likely to run, maybe even
over
a little higher.
Years. Over the next 30
inflation years. May run more like 2.5 or 3% over the next 30 years. It may be lower. But what we're talking about is that means that you're not paying anything on your mortgage. I mean, you're paying principal, and long term, the interest doesn't exist. Now, you don't feel that right now, but the long term implication of that is that we're at a zero interest rate environment when it comes to collateralized loans.
So the question is, when do the headwinds get over with, and that is the thing that is worrying the markets? And I think the answer is in the thing that is causing the markets to go down. At this point, we should break for commercials, right?
Yes, because okay. Leave them hanging on the
clock. I will. I'm going to do that. We have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hey, hang on. Let me try something. Hey, I appreciate the email versions of your market updates rather than the paper. So I know it's more work for you guys, but it's something a little bit more timely. But anyway, having
it's more work
that,
for the writer, but less work for the staff.
Yeah, I like doing the email stuff. Yeah.
Okay. Again, this Barron's article mentions the Schengen agreement.
Right.
And they said,
which is
they
about
said
to go out the window.
Yeah, they said that's
it's dead.
Getting ready to be history. Can you? What is that? And do we care about that? I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. We'll
good question.
That.
Most people have never heard of the Schengen Agreement.
But we're going to say that the thing that's causing the markets to go down
and
is the probable solution to the economic malaise that is around the world.
Yes. And we'll get back to that specifically after the break.
Dun, dun, dun. This is sort of naughty, but we're going to break for commercials. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Telephone numbers in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400. And let's get them off the cliff they are hanging on.
We're going to talk about Schengen?
Well, you
Schengen
wanted,
or whatever it is.
You wanted to...
No, we're not going to tell them what's going to cause the markets. Now, the markets are, and I said earlier I was going to discuss this a little bit, and this is an important thing. Historically, the markets find a rule of thumb, and rule of thumbs, particularly in economics, rules of thumb are dangerous. If the price of oil suddenly plunged in the past in a pretty static environment where there was only so much supply, there was pretty much a fixed supply for a long time, during the time where what was it? Maximum oil was being talked about, how there would just be
peak,
diminished
peak oil.
Peak oil. there would be a diminishing supply of oil into the future. Well, we pretty much said with the technology we have, we got about all the oil we can profitably extract from the ground. Therefore, if the, and this, people form views, and this is called thinking fast as opposed to thinking slow. They get this image of the world. If the price of oil goes up, it's because economic activity went up across the world. If the price of oil goes down, therefore, economic activity has gone down.
Now, right. And you can look at recessions, and you can see that people tend to stop buying gasoline as quickly in recessions because they have less money to do it with. So when the price drops there, it looks like it's because people aren't using the gas. We're using more gas now, and the price has dropped.
Even economists wrote papers after paper about how the price of copper predicted was the most indicative prediction element as to whether or not we were about to have a recession. When the price of copper drops, that means that economic activity is slowing down, and as a result, we're about to have a recession.
We need a big red buzzer button for when economists say things like that. Just say, burr. Because using a commodity, they're only looking at one half of the supply and demand column. They're looking at the demand only.
But
supply is a big – it's half the equation.
It is half the equation. But the point they made, and it was a valid point, is given the technology that was available at that time, given all that they knew about the history of mining and copper, there was a pretty well fixed supply. So what you had is an inflexible supply and a variable demand. Therefore, a movement in price indicated what was going on in demand.
Right.
Well, people learn this as a matter of doctrine or dogma.
Yes. This is the rule. You must follow this rule. When copper prices go up, it means there's high demand. It means economic activity, new electronics being made.
And for whatever it's worth, you can look back at history and you can see that recessions are preceded by high cost of oil. Now, that's an interesting thing because we did have a few years ago, 2 years ago, high cost of oil.
Uh-huh.
The problem is, as Jake just mentioned, when there's a dramatic change in supply, it has an effect on the price. And we had a technological breakthrough in
a lot
both
of them.
In every aspect of mining as we went through the Great Recession, as it's now called, and mining expansion stopped. A lot of companies went out of business, except for the gold mining companies. What happened was new technologies came online that made it very profitable to extract copper and oil from ore bodies, that's what they're called, that previously were not usable. So we have this huge supply hits the market. Now let me finish this out, okay? The price of oil in real terms is lower today than it was in the 1970s or 80s. We had an oil bust, by the way, in the 80s, which we have as a model. If you lower the price of a universally used commodity by about 75%, which is what's happened, you effectively gave the entire world a massive shot of economic stimulus.
Yeah. There's more coming, too. This is part of the reason why Russia has gone to OPEC recently and said, hey, let's talk about lowering the output. This is something that this is, the headline is Russia blinks. They're not able to sustain their own growth, lack of growth. They're not even able to sustain the slow shrinkage in their relatively fast shrinkage in their economy at this level of oil price. Here's the piece of really amazing news that's come out in the last 2 weeks. American fracking companies have been letting leak some information.
Leaks and fracking companies?
Oh, boy, economic. Oh, probably we could go and get ecologists involved with the leaks coming out of the oil fracking. No, the news leaks. Not one, but many fracking companies are continuing to develop and refine the technology that they've used to do fracking. The thought is that the cost to frack should drop by about 75% over the next 2 years. This is a very, very short time period to drop that much cost off of production. The way they're doing it is they're drilling more wells from the same hole, and they're using large data models, data mining, in computer-generated graphics to determine the best way to drill.
So you're saying that instead of copper, we should be looking at data?
Right.
For
yes.
mining purposes?
Yes, data. That's yes. Okay. See, so big data, algorithms basically,
and
plus understanding what the rock formations look like from radar and other techniques that haven't been used like this before, they're bringing the cost significantly down if you're talking about the best technology, which is less expensive than the best technology was 10 years ago, a lot less. If you're talking about the best technology, oil wells shouldn't be dug without getting oil. And if you think about the old movies, the John Wayne movies, the Wildcatters out there digging and hoping to hit something, and they've dug 18 holes and they haven't hit anything, that shouldn't happen anymore with the new technology, which means that there aren't going to be a lot of expenses going in to expensive oil. It's going to be finding the cheap oil and digging for that.
Mm-hmm.
And what's more, the most expensive part of fracking isn't digging the original hole, it's the actual act of spraying in all the stuff to get the fracking done. So if you dig the holes and you wait for the price to come up before you do the fracking, what we have is this massive supply buildup in the ground that all it takes is a minor upward movement in the price for more supply to come gushing out quickly.
Literally.
Literally.
And what does that mean? When you look at your budget, you can get a really good image of what's going on in the world. If you were to sit down and determine how much money you spent a year ago on gasoline versus how much money you spent, you're spending at this point on gasoline, you'll find out that your cost of gasoline has probably dropped significantly.
And probably to about a quarter of what you were paying.
So here's what's happening next. I wouldn't say it was a quarter because we're only at $2, roughly $2, a dollar something to $2 a gallon. But I would
say half.
So they were at four?
If you're getting your regular unleaded, it was right at four.
A year ago?
No, 2 years ago.
Okay.
It's now right around 150.
Okay, so here's the point that I want to make. You may find that you're actually not seeing that big a savings on gasoline, and the reason is you're driving more.
Yeah.
You're making more trips, and when you get to the end of the trip, you're spending money. You don't drive out there just, oh, let's just go drive. People used to do that, but they don't anymore. It's too much traffic.
Sunday drivers. Yeah, don't drive anymore. So, too many people are doing it.
So the point is that people are spending, and by the way, that's what drove the economy last quarter and last year, as normal, is the American public spending, and they're not spending as much as the economists think they should. But here is my point. What's going to turn the world around to turn things back to profit to eventually pay off the excess debt that's held mainly, by the way, outside the United States? And the answer is the low cost of oil, the thing that the market seems to fear right now. This is a classic down market in that it is irrational economically. It is one of those opportunities, if you have a little extra money to put into a diversified portfolio or not take out, as the case may be. So we're in a position where we're very much afraid of the thing that is probably going to rescue the world economy. And I realize that that is completely contrarian, but that is the nature of what we do. It is the nature of the real world market. Have we seen the bottom yet? I don't know. I tend to think probably not. But on the other hand, we've had a lot of indicators at the bottom. What's his name? Gross. Bill Gross has come out and said the market has got to fall a lot further. And
that's
we'll
a great
in.
Indicator that we're as low as we're going to get.
And there's been several other bond managers who've come out and predicted a massive decline in the market, a huge bear market. Generally speaking, when the bond managers come out and predict a massive fall in the stock market, that marks the bottom. We've had some of our other private indicators. There are certain people who give us a call panicked when they're afraid the bottom is going to fall out and ask if they should bail out of the market. And that is generally an indicator that we've had what's known as capitulation and then we've hit the bottom. I don't know. A lot of things could happen going forward. What I can say without any danger of contradiction is some extremely healthy companies, more specifically, the major U.S. banks are trading, as Jake actually showed me one last week, 7 or 8 times their earnings, which just came out and broke records. Their earnings are good. Even if every, and what they have revealed now since they've done their quarterly reports,
right,
if every oil-related, even vaguely oil-related, or indirectly oil-related loan went bad,
they'd still be fine.
They have cash on hand to cover those loans. Now, that's not what the situation was in 2007.
Right. If every mortgage loan went bad, the American economy would tank again. But every mortgage loan didn't go bad.
Right.
That was part of the falsity in how far the market dropped, is we didn't know how much was going to go wrong.
Banks across the board, the large investment banks and regular banks, the ones that were systemically dangerous to the economy and nearly took us down, were holding about 4% reserves against loans in 2007. Today, it's 8 to 10% against reserves, and the oil patch, as big as it is nowhere as big as the real estate patch, and I can't find any indications anywhere that real estate's overpriced.
What's more, and this is important, if an oil company goes bankrupt, they're unable to pump the oil out. As I said, this is a short-term issue because one of the fascinating things that's happening right now is the big companies are scooping up the little companies' assets in the oil patch. They've got cash on hand.
They're playing grab assets.
Grab assets, yes. They've got cash on hand. They are not going to lower their reserves too much. But if there are nearly bankrupt companies, they're just stepping in and saying, we'll help the bank. We'll buy all those assets and give some money, and your bank will get some of their money back.
Interestingly enough, the Federal Reserve, and apparently, I guess that the Federal Reserve influenced the major banks, but the major banks apparently did it. When they made these oil loans, or these oil pipeline loans, they put themselves, and they insisted on being the number one creditor in a bankruptcy. They actually wrote into the contracts that all the bonds and all the other money that you borrow is secondary to our loan. Now, why is that important? If a major oil company or a big drilling company or a pipeline company goes under, the bank, in essence, owns the company. If there's not enough money to pay beyond the bank, then the other creditors get to walk away and cry in their beer, and the bank winds up owning a bunch of oil or a bunch of pipeline, which, by the way, they're in a financial position to sit on for a while until it becomes. And by the way, once the debt is off of there, they probably can turn around and make a profit on this thing or sell it at a profit. So if you look through the chain, which is what took us down, is that invisible chain of liability.
You follow the
chain. 2007 through 2009.
We see the end of the chain.
Right. The point is the chain has been very carefully analyzed in advance in this case.
Not in the other case.
Now, if you happen to be a purchaser of junk bonds, which is, by the way, what they were using to finance the rest of it.
You're in bad shape.
You'll notice that the percentage of junk bonds that is considered likely to go bad, and we don't know which ones, is around 30%. We are running out of time in the first hour. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. And if you'd like to contact us off the air, we have a local telephone number. And the local telephone number is, of course, during the weekend. We're going to have voicemail. We have live people that answer the phone during the week, and it's 947-1111.
You can reach that toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us directly, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com, or tpwc.com. You can listen to podcasts there. You can read our philosophy. Our newsletter gets posted up there. It's worth taking a look at. You can also see our beautiful staff and our ugly mugs. So until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
News Radio 1400 KTEM. Serving Central Texas, KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.